several places in Hosea where Israel is mentioned. And, you know, I, for one, as moderator, had sort of been counting on Brother Ken for that, and I think probably Brother Rick, when we get to Zechariah, had similar things in mind as well. But, you know, we believe that all things work together. And I'm so happy that the tragedy wasn't worse than it was. But by the Lord's providential overruling, I'm sure that the things that Brother Ken may have said will be put into the hearts of these dear brethren, and we'll be able to praise our Heavenly Father and take something nice from this study this weekend. We have been assigned the book of Hosea. I think some say Hosea, some say Hosea, an apple by any other name, still an apple. Hosea was the son of Beeri. We're not told too much about him, but his name means deliverance or salvation. Very interesting that an individual that we know well from the time of Moses by the name of Joshua was originally named Hosea. In the book of Hosea, the prophecies concern almost exclusively Israel, the 10-tribe kingdom. Judah is mentioned several times in passing, but it's not the focus of this particular prophecy. Within Israel, the tribe of Ephraim is mentioned 37 times. Now, Ephraim, in most cases, is nearly synonymous with Israel. It was the chief tribe of Israel, very influential. I'm sure you hear quite a lot more about Ephraim and what Ephraim represents. Israel's capital, Samaria, is mentioned 6 times. Jerusalem is not mentioned at all in the book of Hosea. Hosea served for an unusually long time as a prophet. He began near the end of the reign of Jeroboam II. And during this time, Israel had risen to its peak of prosperity and influentiality. However, even at this time, it didn't have a good record of service to its covenanted creator. Hosea served as prophet through the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, all the way to Hezekiah. Probably a minimum of 60 years, though one commentator mentioned he could have been serving as long as 66 years. Contemporary prophets with Hosea included Amos, Isaiah, Micah, and an obscure prophet by the name of Oded that 2 Chronicles 28 mentions. It certainly is a book that was inspired by God because it is quoted in the New Testament. Jesus himself in Luke 23:30 makes a reference that may be found in the book of Hosea. After Jeroboam II died, by the way, this is all in preparation, kind of give you a feeling for what was going on at the time he gave his prophecy. After Jeroboam II died, Israel fell into a terrible period of history, actually all the way to the end of her existence. There was a reign of terror with a number of rulers being assassinated, and it continued down till when the Assyrians came and took the nation in captivity. During that time, you can see that there's political factions fighting with one another. In particular, to try to gain political control, one faction wanted to be joined with Assyria, another faction wanted to be joined with Egypt. Political alliances, you see, in their minds, were the way to go. Faith in God, it would appear, was not very important at all. Finally, the purpose that God sent Hosea to the nation was to make very clear to them their unfaithfulness, their contamination with Baal worship. In Hosea's day, Israel had been transformed, or at least their religion had been transformed, into a riotous, drunken ceremony that included immoral relations with temple prostitutes. Israel attributed her prosperity to Baal, not to Jehovah. And she was disloyal to God and despised the covenant by the actions that the whole nation took. And so Hosea was sent, and her prophecy, to make it very clear to Israel that such behavior was not to be tolerated. God, in fact, would not tolerate it anymore. And to reveal to her exactly how bad that she was. I think that gives us at least a ground to begin our study with. We've broken up most of the chapters in Hosea in terms of organization. We've assigned various chapters to the brethren on the panel, and a few of the chapters we're going to consider together as a panel. Our first section will be chapters 1 through 3. And we'd like to begin, and I haven't had a lot of time to talk to the panel in advance, so dear brethren, besides the questions that you were assigned, if you want to elucidate on what the chapter as a whole has to say and how it relates to the other chapter, please do. You know, on a personal note, I guess I should say one thing. After receiving the assignment, when I first started reading through the book of Hosea, I did not find it to be an encouraging book. reading through the judgments was very discouraging. And, you know, you kind of scratch your head and you ask, how can a people in covenant relationship with God go so bad? And you read page after page of repetitious judgment. My first impression was not really a positive one. And perhaps that's the way that the prophecy was intended to be. It was intended to hit them right between the eyes and let them know, hey, you people are living and behaving just the opposite of what your righteous God has directed you to. You've completely turned your back on him. And so it is not an encouraging book in many of its passages. But by the same token, it's not a totally discouraging book. As we go through this, you'll find that there's judgments that are given that are very bad in their description. But invariably, there are promises that are given once again. And you see this alternation between condemnation and hope, condemnation and healing, condemnation and restoral and restoration. The book is very much laid out that way. And again, as we go through it, we hope that some of these points will start to become clear to you. Beginning in chapter 1, we are introduced to somebody by the name of Gomer, and Hosea was asked to marry her. Brother Rick?
Brother David, I was just wondering before that, did you mention who he might have been contemporary with?
I did not, and I think that I do have that here. Thank you, brother. Yeah, I did mention contemporary promises. Yes, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, and Oded, and there's really quite a number of parallel passages between Hosea and Amos. Did you have something additional in mind?
Well, we were just going to say, you mentioned Isaiah as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the kings that were mentioned here at the beginning, this was nice. We'll just rattle this off real quick. Uzziah reigned 52 years, considered a good king. Jotham reigned 16 years, considered a good king. Ahaz reigned 16 years. He was considered a bad king. And, in fact, he introduced Baal worship right in Jerusalem, closed the temple. And Hezekiah, 29 years. He was considered a good king. So that's 113 years. So you could see, as was said, we don't think Hosea would have prophesied that whole period, but parts of that period. And they were all, those four kings were kings of the two-tribe kingdom of Judah, whereas Jeroboam II, he reigned 41 years, but he would have been over the ten-tribe kingdom, and his reign would have overlapped these previous kings. So when we read these different prophets who were contemporary, one of the keys we can do is we can look and see what reign they prophesied during, and then that gives us some confidence that we're having an understanding when they reigned, as well as the message they gave. And we would just say Hosea prophesied to all 12 tribes, but predominantly to the 10-tribe kingdom.
Yeah. You know, it is amazing when you think of how patient God was in these years that Brother Rick just mentioned. All of these things were going on. There were good things, and there were good kings, as Brother Rick mentioned. But the bad stuff that just kept continuing and whatnot, you would have surmised that even to faithful ones, they probably had their faith stretched by this, maybe scratching their heads and saying, how can Jehovah continue to permit this? Why doesn't he do something about it? Well, even in the psalmist at one point asks, come forth, Jehovah, plead your own legal case. Let people know what it is that you're doing. But we're thankful for the patience of Jehovah because things do work out ultimately in a way that is a blessing toward all people and a praise to him. All right, back to our first question. Who was Gomer? And why was Hosea told to marry her? Who would like to start out? Brother Wes?
Gomer, we are introduced to, I believe, in verse 3, chapter 1. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. So Gomer and Hosea were husband and wife. As we read down through the verses to follow, we learn very quickly that Gomer was not a faithful spouse, but Gomer was a very unfaithful spouse. And so we think that perhaps one of the things that the Lord was doing for Hosea was preparing him to be able to write a very important prophecy. And he had to be able to write as God would have been able to have written the prophecy from the standpoint of his relationship with Israel. So he was really preparing, he had prepared Hosea through this very difficult experience for Hosea, prepared him in a very personal way to write in a very appropriate manner, the way that that God wanted him to write.
Yeah, that's a very good point, that Hosea is sort of feeling in this personal way that Brother Wes is talking about, how God must have felt. You know, and that's not the first time that God has brought very personal feelings into something that he wanted to communicate. Was Abraham ever involved in something where personal feelings were involved, Father Abraham? Folks on the panel? Brother John?
Certainly in the experience of Abraham offering Isaac, and you think what a privilege it is for, you know, Abraham to have an experience where he's typifying God and the feeling that God had toward his son. And, you know, from one standpoint, it's terrible to think what Hosea went through, but he also got an insight into what God's experience was. And you think about this, that can you think of an experience where a greater disloyalty or unfaithfulness could be shown? And it really demonstrates the depths to which Israel had fallen. By contrast, it also shows the methods God uses to correct, recover. And I think that's the wonderful thing about this, the mercy and the recovery, which is ultimate by means of these experiences that the nation had. I keep thinking of the scripture, behold the goodness and the severity of God, because I think we see here both those things illustrated.
Thank you. Very good. All right, our next question, who is Jezreel? Brother Bob?
Jezreel is the first son. I was going to make a comment. I'm sorry I didn't get my hand up quick enough.
Oh,
about
do.
Gomer.
Mm-hmm.
It says in the scripture about Gomer that she is a wife of harlotries. And what I found interesting was that according to the rabbis, if she was at the time he married her a harlot, the name for her would have been Ish Isha or Ish Shaha or something like that. I can't quite. Zoma. But it's not that. And the word that was used implies that, at least the rabbis think, that she would have drifted to this. So this is the direction of that particular expression. And Jezreel means God sows. And this was his initial experience. When God, for example, if we perceive the relationship of Israel to God and Gomer to Hosea, this first child would have been the production of a proper relationship. And in the beginning, God did not marry a harlot, but she became a harlot. And he did have this first child, God sows, Jezreel, and there was some productivity in the community before they went into their severity of harlotry.
Mm-hmm.
And this is revealed, I think, when you get into the next chapter, chapter 2, where it opens up saying, say unto your brethren, Ami, and to your sisters, Ruma. I think there's an expression here in this description in the earlier part of chapter 2 that I think he's really talking to Jezreel, having him communicate to the other siblings who were not his children, that they should impress upon their mother what's going on and kind of wake her up. And this, of course, has larger applications. Referring it to your brethren, to your sisters, not to one brother, one sister. There were not that many children.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Bob, I'm going to pick up on your comment because this was you had mentioned to me this morning or this point that when we read in verse 2 where Hosea said, go take thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, that the way that the King James translates it makes us think that he's going out to marry a prostitute. And in fact, some commentaries say that. But what you're suggesting is that that's not completely correct based upon the rabbinic understanding of that word, that she had fallen and failed somewhat afterward in her morality, and that would correspond more with God taking Israel, who was not a whore at the beginning or a prostitute at the beginning. Is that your thought?
Yes.
All right, good, good. That was a little bit different than what I had read some elsewhere. Any other comments on that point? All right, so Gomer marries Hosea, and they have this child, Jezreel, which means God will disperse. Then we go on, we find that there are some other children that come into existence. Our next question is, who is Lo-Ruhamah and who is Lo-Ammi? Who are these individuals? Brother John?
Well, Gomer has two more children, and Lo-Ruhamah means unpitied or orphan, and Lo-Ammi means not my people. So we can see Hosea, you know, you can think of the angst in a family of realizing the unfaithfulness and him not wanting to recognize these children. And so the Lord, I think, as you see...
Now, are you saying that they're not his children?
They're not his children, neither one. Yeah, so, but the Lord is using, there'll be a play on the names we'll see later.
Yes.
I think Jezreel is very interesting because it has, if I can add, it has the aspect of God will sow. But if you think about how they sowed in ancient times, it was a broadcast, you know, as you said, dispersing. So we can also think of it as God scattering. So that name can mean a positive, God sowing, planting, but it can also mean a scattering.
Yes, very, very important point. It has this two aspects. The idea of throwing about is intrinsic in the name, but as Brother John said, it can be a dispersal in a negative way, a disassimilation or disintegration, or it can be the dispersal, the sowing of seed. Brother Bob?
Brother David, I noted in reprint page 2490, when Brother Russell is discussing these names that Brother John just told us, and this is a very slight difference, but it's just a little added thought on how Hosea may have personally felt this. He quotes from a George Adam Smith, and he says, "The name Lo-Ruhamah, she that never knew a father's love, and the other one, Lo-Ammi, the other child, no kin of mine." Instead of not my people. So you see the two our understanding of the application goes to the bigger, broader Israel picture, but it also has this personal thing. A child, she that never knew a father's love.
Mm. Yeah, very, very poignant.
Sad.
Yes, yes. Brother Rick, please.
Well, I was looking in our own mind and thinking about this. We have Gomer, Jezreel, Lo-Ruhamah, and Lo-Ammi. We have four individuals, Hosea picturing God. And we will just make the suggestion that Gomer pictures all 12 tribes through their entire experience. It started out good, and then they committed harlotry, as brought out. Jezreel was the first child who, in verse 4, God says he's going to avenge. So this must be a child that he owns up to and loves, and in fact, Jezreel, that name reappears later in verse 11, and it's a positive. So we're going to suggest that Jezreel pictured Israel from the time of their exodus up until the time that the ten-tribe division took place. It was a positive relationship at that time. Then Lo-Ruhamah would picture the ten-tribe kingdom, when they split off and started idolatry. And then Lo-Ammi would picture the two-tribe kingdom. And they both had problems, and they were chastised. But then we do see that they're regained later on when we get to that. Chapter 2, verse 1 would be a verse on that. So that when they're regained, it goes back to a picture of Jezreel as being the positive. They're back as all 12 tribes in a good relationship. So Gomer shows how it started good and with all 12 tribes and went bad. Jezreel showed that when they were all 12 tribes at the beginning of their experience, that's what the Lord wanted. The two other children show the 10 tribe, two tribes split. And then it shows how he actually even regains them, and they all are back together as the 12 tribes. And I would offer that as a suggestion on why you have these four characters.
I like that suggestion. And perhaps in showing how Jezreel comes to mean that final picture, Brother Rick, I'd ask you to read verses 10 and 11 in chapter 1, the last two verses of that first chapter. And as Brother Rick's reading us, keep in mind his application here of Jezreel representing the condition of Israel in God's favor at the beginning, but then ultimately at the end, since this has that prophetic meaning. Brother Rick, please.
Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel.
So you see, at the beginning of the chapter here, we have this very discouraging stuff, this hard judgment that God is bringing there. And of course, Hosea experiencing this in a very personal way, with his domestic life being rather unhinged. But then again, the last two verses, we have kind of something positive here. Notice that expression, the number of the children shall be as the sand of the sea. Where have we seen that before? Anyone? By the way, I hope the panel will forgive me. You know, I frequently will ask questions that are not on the list here, but this is relevant. Where have we seen sands of the sea before? Brother John?
And the Abrahamic promise. That's the second part to the earthly seed.
Yes, the second part. You know, the sands of the sea is not the only way within the various iterations of the Abrahamic promise that Israel was suggested. There was another synonym or another symbol. Said they would also be like the dust of the earth. Remember at one point? That's earlier. Ultimately, it's the sand of the sea. Whenever you see the sand of the sea, it's kind of positive. But dust of the earth isn't so positive. Why the difference between the two? Especially in view of the positive reference here in Hosea. Anyone have a thought on that? Brother Rick?
When I think of dust, I think of being humbled under the mighty hand of God. And after they pass through their humbling experience of their waywardness, then they're blessed in the peaceable kingdom picture of being as the sand of the sea. It's only until the resurrection begins to take place can you acquire this number of the sand of
yes,
the sea.
Exactly, that's right. What is one element that's missing from the dust of the earth and present in the sands of the sea? Brother John?
I'm not sure if you're thinking this, but I'm thinking dust is basically dirt, whereas sand are very small particles of rock.
Okay. All right, that's true, but there's another element missing. What is not in dust? In fact, if it would be in dust, it wouldn't be dust anymore.
Water.
Water. What does water represent? Truth. So you have a picture of the dust of the earth showing Israel without truth. You know, they're kind of crushed down. Dust is made by repeated crushings and whatnot. So early on in the Abrahamic covenant, you have them described that way, because early on in their experiences, they lose the truth. They lose that element. But is there any water near the sands of the sea? How much water? A lot of water. And so here in Hosea, when it says the children shall be as the sands of the sea, it harkens back to the Abrahamic covenant and to the ultimate blessing that will come to Israel. This is the blessing, again, Brother Rick denoted as the Jezreel picture, the full and complete picture. All right, let's go on to chapter 2. What lessons does... let's ask this first. In verse 1, and Brother Rick, one of the brethren, quoted it, so say unto your brethren, Ammi, and your sisters, Rahumah. What do these names mean? And how are they different? Brother Wes.
Well, if we run a careful comparison, we notice that the prefix lo, L-O, is now missing from the same two names. The word lo means no or not. So just as before you had lo, Rahumah, meant no compassion or no pity, that now means compassion or pity. And lo ami means not my people. Now ami means my people. So you drop the lo, and now you go from being disfavored, essentially, to being favored.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this connects up with the last two verses of chapter 1. Again, just to note that the chapter and verse divisions that we find in Scripture are not inspired. These were put in by writers and copyists and whatnot to make being able to find a scripture easy. In fact, if we didn't have these chapters, it would be very difficult in a convention or any study to find a scripture. But this is an example of where this chapter 2 division kind of interrupts the flow of the thought here, that is still talking about not my people being my people and not favored being favored. Brother Rick.
Well, Brother David, it's an interesting observation that when the children of Israel came back from the 70 years desolation. There was no more idolatry, the gross idolatry like Baal worship and Moloch worship committed by them that we had read, which led them into this great desolation and these punishments. So when we were suggesting that Jezreel showed Israel, all 12 tribes, in a more positive relationship, it was before the gross idolatry had taken over. We remember that there was some idolatry, a bit here, a bit there. But when the 10-tribe kingdom under Jeroboam split off, remember, he introduced the calf worship of Samaria, and then the Baal worship spread. And so then all their kings were bad. And then the 2-tribe kingdom during that time, some of the kings, and Ahaz was the first one to bring Baal worship right into Jerusalem, and it's recorded. He closed the temple and started worshiping at another arrangement that he saw when he was in Damascus. He saw pagan worship, idolatrous worship there, and he commanded his priests to copy that in Jerusalem. It's recorded in Scripture in Kings under Ahaz. So the point is that the 2 tribes and the 10 tribes were taken away for this gross idolatry. That was as Lo Ruhama and Lo Ami. But when they're brought back from the 70 years desolation, all 12 tribes, they are regained, and that gross idolatry isn't there. What they suffered after that was Phariseeism. And, of course, that's what the Master dealt with in his day. But it was a holiness people that ran amok. So we won't go any further that way, but we don't see the gross idolatry. Jesus didn't have to deal with the gross idolatry in Israel in his day, and this is kind of the background of it.
Very interesting observation. Let's go on here in chapter 2. What lesson does Jehovah teach, or intend to teach, or intend Israel to learn through prosperity or the lack of prosperity? Anyone want to take that one up? Well, let's read a verse and see if we can understand what it means. In chapter 2, let's look at verse 5. For their mother hath played the harlot, she that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, that give me my bread and my water, my wool, my flax, mine oil, and mine drink. What is she saying? Brother Bob, please.
When Israel came out of Egypt, and this is partially related to a commentary that a guide gave us when we were in Israel, they were not familiar with the land. And literally, they probably had a little more difficult time in the land after coming out of Egypt eating manna, settling in and making the land prosperous. The guide suggested, and I think the scriptures back this up, that Israel was in a situation where they looked around them and they saw their neighbors who were idol worshippers doing quite well. And they began to realize they had to learn these practices. And they may have even tried that, but then they may have drifted into thinking that, well, listen, their God is blessing them. And then, of course, we know that there was intermarriage and so forth and so on. But dragging ourselves through this whole mess that they were in, they obviously eventually came to the point where they were turning, like Gomer, to others for whatever they could get. And evidently Gomer was one who sold herself first to earn whatever she wanted for herself, or maybe just because she was promiscuous in mind and heart. The land was filled with this anyway. Mm-hmm. And so Israel likewise drifted into this idolatry, putting aside the bond that they had with their God, and began to pick up these idol-worshipping behavior. At the same time, they also, like Gomer, were looking for something for substance for themselves, worshiping a god that was not a god, with the intention of getting the benefits from that god to bring prosperity to themselves.
Mm-hmm. So there was great confusion in their minds about where these blessings were coming from, the source of these blessings, because of those circumstances.
And the Lord pointed out to them this very thing, that they were missing this point, that what he had given them, they were attributing to others.
Yeah, that's right. Bob, would you read in chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, on that last point?
For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof and my wine in the season thereof, and I will recover my wool and my flax and give and given to cover her nakedness.
Okay, so what is the threat there that God is giving? The observation and the threat? Someone else? Bob, again?
I'm sorry, famine. And yeah. Samaria did experience some famine, some serious famine. It's the story of the king who experienced someone coming to him and saying, look, this woman and I made an arrangement. We were going to eat her child, my child, one day and eat her child the next, but she wouldn't give me her child to eat the next day. And the king was like astonished beyond words. He fell over. That was the time when the Assyrians eventually left, and there was a great abundance. But there was a terrible famine in Samaria.
The whole Abraham, not the whole Abraham, the whole Mosaic Law covenant was a covenant where God showed his favor of the nation by giving them prosperity. And he showed his disfavor by taking away that prosperity. And so they were getting confused. They got some things as a result of bad behavior, and as Bob illustrated quite nicely, this moved them in a mindset that was bad. They began to attribute to the false gods all of their prosperity. Well, God says he's going to reassert himself, and in fact did. As we go down in this chapter, we find some more references to how God is going to use prosperity to bless. And in so doing, he begins to set up a larger picture. In fact, what we would call a millennial picture that administratively shows how he's going to bless Israel. Would anyone care to comment on how this structure of the kingdom is shown pictorially here in chapter 2? Perhaps we could start at verse 18. If somebody could read that and comment on it. Brother Russ, please.
In verse 18, again, we're in chapter 2. And in that day will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and with the fowls of heaven and with the creeping things of the ground. And I will break the bow and the sword of the battle out of the earth and will make them to lie down safely. The word that our eyes focused on there in that verse is the word covenant, because the kingdom, the structure of the kingdom is going to be a covenant structure. That will be, that's what we attribute to the millennial age, the association with the new law covenant. Mm-hmm. So that's one way. We have various pictures as we work down through these verses, but that was the one that our eyes went to in that particular verse.
Yeah. And a few verses prior to that, in verse 15, we have another reference that also makes us think of the setting up of the kingdom and of the end of the gospel age and beginning of the millennial age. Could someone comment on the thoughts there in verse 15? Brother Rick, please.
Just in 15, we'd like to actually read 14 and 15 quickly. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her, and I will give her her vineyards from thence in the valley of Achor for a door of hope. And she shall sing there as in the days of her youth and as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. Just here, he's bringing her to the wilderness. This is showing that after the whoredoms, he's now bringing her back, bringing Israel back into a relationship. And this, we think, is all the way down at the Second Advent, beginning in 1878, where the Lord, after her 1845-year period of disfavor, now she's being brought back, and the Lord is going to speak comfortably, Isaiah 40, verse 1. Her warfare time has expired, the 1845 years of disfavor. But for me, it was very helpful to note that the Valley of Achor really means Valley of Trouble. And Dora Hope, the word hope, is the word tikva. So when we talk about Petatikva as the initial kibbutz community in 1878 in Israel, that's Door of Hope. But it is not in the location in Israel of the Valley of Achor. The Valley of Achor is actually on the east side of Israel, where they first entered the land, over, where if you think of like Jericho, over in that side. And the Valley of Achor is where, remember Achan, the rebel, when they went up to take the city of Ai, when they first entered the land, he took some of the gold and stuff and hid it in his tent, and they had to slay Achan for this deed, and he was trouble to the nation. So that was in the Valley of Achor. So there was trouble when they first entered the land. But now when they're coming at the second advent back into the land, the Lord's saying it's a door of hope. It's going to be much more hopeful for you now than the first time you entered the land and you had this trouble with Achan in the Valley of Achor. So there's a play there on words, but both have to do with Israel coming into the land.
Thank you. I really appreciated that connection with 1878 and Petah Tikva as a door of hope, and that the restoring of Israel to their land and to their promises is not going to be easy process. It's going to be an Achor process, a process that's full of trouble, and yet one also that's full of hope. The last verse in this second chapter here, I just want a couple more comments on. In verses 21 through 23, it reads, "And it shall come to pass in that day, I will hear, saith Jehovah, I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth. And the earth shall hear the corn, and the wine, and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. I will say unto them which were not my people, Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God." Just a few comments on the concluding verses of this second chapter here, how it relates to the kingdom blessings. Who would like to just make a comment or two? Brother West, please.
Well, a few things. In verse 21, we talk about, he says, "And I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth." That reminds us of the two phases of the kingdom,
yes,
the heavenly phase and the spiritual phase of God's kingdom. In verse 22, we have a reference to the corn, the wine, and the oil. Corn is a food, so this is nourishment. This will be not the husks. The world is no longer going to be feeding on husks. They're going to be feeding on good food. Wine we often associate with doctrine. So perhaps here we might see a reference to the wine of the kingdom. Our Lord referenced that at the time of the memorial. And also the oil, we often associate oil with joy or with the Holy Spirit. And we talk about the pouring of the Spirit out upon all flesh. So again, we can see a lot of kingdom concepts in the corn, the wine, and the oil. And in verse 23, it just reminds us of, it says, "Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God." Here's a beautiful relationship being reestablished between God and the people. Now, it's going to take some time, as we know, to mediate the new covenant until all are back into atonement. But that this last phrase just reminds us of the phrase we've often heard, "I only have eyes for you." And that's eventually what's going to happen between God and his creation.
Thank you, Brother West. I could have asked you to sing that verse. Yeah, this is, again, it's beautiful. You can see in the second chapter you have judgment, then you have hope, and then you have a clear statement of what will the result of that be. Jezreel, God will sowing all of these things. Once again, the old law covenant was a covenant that prosperity signified God's favor. The new covenant will be the same thing. That the covenant mentioned up in verse 18 will eventually result in prosperity. And then you see the two sides of the kingdom, the earthly state and the heavenly state, and the communication that would exist between them, and the profit and the prosperity that would come. It's really a very beautiful picture of that whole kingdom arrangement. Well, I see Brother Laddie here to pause us for the halfway point, so I will turn it over to him. Thank you, Brother Laddie. In chapter 3, we return once again to Gomer and to Hosea. And he has said there in verse 1, "Now said the Lord unto me, Go yet, love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord to the children of Israel, who took other gods and loved flagons of wine. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and an omer of barley," and a half an omer of barley. There's a repurchasing going on. Looks like Hosea is repurchasing Gomer once again. This price here of 15 pieces of silver and 1.5 omers of barley. What does this signify or suggest to our minds? Brother John?
In our studies, it appears that the omer and a half also equals 15 shekels, which brings it to a total of 30, which is the price that Judah sold the Lord for. And it calls to mind the fact that Israel would have been under double condemnation, needing his sacrifice not just as the ransom, but also because they were under the condemnation of the law.
Okay, very good. Any other suggestions? Brother Rick, please.
Exodus 21:32 reads, If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So this is a manservant or a maidservant. So a slave price is 30 shekel. There also might be the thought here that when God purchases back Israel after all this harlotry of idolatrous worship, it's as if she's spent. She's totally humble. She's not worth the price of a slave. It's like the worst of pictures that you can imagine of a woman whose life of harlotry has left her a old broken woman. Yet the Lord can deal with Israel in that condition, and he still loves her for the patriarch's sakes and brings her back, even though she's only sold for half price. The other thought, too, is barley is associated with, in Numbers 5:15, with the jealousy offering that you were to bring to a priest. And the Lord is jealous for Israel in other verses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. In verse 3, what Hosea says, that you're not going to play the harlot anymore, that you're going to abide with me for many days. And verse 4 makes an application of that. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king, without prince, without sacrifice, without image, without an ephod, without a teraphim. How did that, in fact, come true? Brother West?
Well, where our minds were inclined on this is that, as we see in the natural relationship between Hosea and Gomer, Hosea repurchases Gomer. And she comes back, as we understand it, to live in his household. But yet, there was a strained relationship there. It wasn't the warm, close association that initially existed in that marriage. And this is the way, so God's relationship to Israel is more of a distant relationship. It's more of a servant relationship than it is a close, warm, spousal type relationship. And of course, that went on for a period of years.
Yeah. In fact, when they came back from Babylon, they returned to the land. But a lot of things were missing from that. They didn't have polity. They weren't in control. They were slaves to the king that was in power, in control at that time. And even if we bring it all the way up to the time of Jesus, eventually they were thrown out of the land to go into the lands of the dispersal, the Jewish dispersion. And there they didn't have king. They didn't have prince. They didn't have the sacrifices. They didn't have the ephod. They were devoid of all those things for the whole period of the second Jewish double. But, and here's, again, this tends to be a feature of Hosea. You have these difficult things mentioned, and then how does it conclude? Look at verse 5. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, and shall love the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Again, now we're looking beyond the end of Israel's double, the Jewish double. We're looking now to her complete and full restoration. Not merely, as Brother West suggested, dwelling more or less in the same house, at least from their standpoint, but not having the same relationship, but having that full relationship restored once again. Well, let's move on to chapter 4, and we're going to have to speed up a little bit. The poor brethren here in this class have asked me to cover the whole chapter, and we've barely gotten through three chapters or the whole book. Let me read verses 1 through 4 of chapter 4. I'm going to ask a question about it. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel, for the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out and blood toucheth blood. Therefore shall the land mourn, and every one that dwelleth therein shall languish, with the beasts of the field and with the fowls of the heaven. Yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. Yet let no man strive nor reprove another, for thy people are as they that strive with a priest. These conditions sound pretty bad. Was it really this bad, or is this an exaggeration? How bad was it in Israel? Brother John, you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I want to say first, one of the things that struck me as I read through all the prophets, I keep thinking of Micah 6:8, what did the Lord require of thee but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God? And we see in verse 1, they mention no truth, no mercy, nor knowledge of the God. And they had missed the laws of the truth that would have taught them righteousness, and the knowledge of God would have made them humble. So we think those things are referenced there. Verse 2 shows five things that are direct violations of the Ten Commandments. And, you know, brethren, at this time, the nation of Israel had not only gone away from the kingdom of David and adopted the calf worship, they had gone into Baal worship, Moloch, as had been mentioned. And we believe at this time, this is a little after. It's interesting, verse 1 mentions Jeroboam as a king of Israel, but it doesn't mention the ones that followed him. There's a period of great trial in Israel where four of the last six kings were all killed and replaced by a successor. So I believe this is a reference to that time period when the example set before the people, whoever was the strongest would just take the throne, kill the preceding one, and go on. And verse 3, I think, is a reference back to famine and the fact that Israel was being blessed naturally, that when the Lord corrected them, the corrections would be natural, meant that the whole land would have to suffer, the animals and everything within it. And then verse 4, you know, it's kind of ironic. If all are in this condition, how can one reprove another one? It's, you know, you can't really say you're wrong when you're all wrong.
You know, Brother John mentioned how one kingship was replaced by another because of assassination and rulers and whatnot. I think that's suggested in verse 2 by this blood touches blood, that murder had become so rampant that there was no space between the murders. One bloody murder followed by another bloody murder. Exactly right. What's God's judgment regarding this, Brother John? Brother John, by the way, has chapter 4, so I'm not picking on him.
Well, in verse 5, they're going to be destroyed. Neither day nor night can help them, and the destruction of their mother could be a reference back to the whole nation, because this is interesting. He has a controversy not with the nation, but with all the people, verse 1 says. Mm-hmm. So I think it's showing both the destruction of them personally because of these sins, but also the destruction of the national polity as well, of the 10-tribe kingdom.
John, what would you say was their chief problem? I mean, what was the core problem here with Israel?
Well, it depends on the prophet. Hosea, I think, is showing the idolatry aspect, which, you know, is represented in the harlotry, that they had gone after false gods, and you're going to verse 6, that you can sum it up basically by saying they didn't have the knowledge of the Lord. And I think this is such an amazing thing. It says they had rejected knowledge. Reminds us in 2 Peter 3 of what's spoken about the scoffers, that they were willingly ignorant. They had all the providences of God from the past laid out before them. They had the statute which told them to take care of the widow and the orphan and the fatherless. They had all these things. They had the corrections of the Lord that also came through his providence, and they rejected that knowledge and wanted to go after false gods. And so because they were rejected, their position was rejected as well, and God would forget their children, which I think is a reference to the course that they were going on would become more and more degraded, so he would have to cut off that nation in order to rescue them. That's the sense of how he would forget their children.
Yeah, I like your reference to Peter, willingly ignorant. You know, they're destroyed not simply because they're innocently ignorant, but they've rejected knowledge, it says. And that's a totally different thing. Now, when Peter talks about the willingly ignorant, it's that they don't want to. It's like that little saying, you know, don't confuse me with the truth. People don't want to know the truth. They're comfortable where they are. That's their comfort zones. They don't want to disrupt that in any way. For Israel, they were comfortable in their sin, in their idolatry, in their lasciviousness, their unrighteousness. They had the capacity to know. Their ignorance wasn't because of diminished capacity. It's because they rejected the knowledge. All right, Brother John, let's jump over to verse 15 through the end of the chapter there. There are references to general references to places here and the nations. I wonder if you could just give a sketch on each one. Israel, Judah, Gilgal, Bethaven, and Ephraim.
You understand here there's a distinction made in verse 15 between Israel and Judah. Israel playing the harlot, but he's also saying, let not Judah offend. And I think it's interesting what Brother Rick mentioned earlier. Except for Ahaz, the kings of Judah at this time were good kings, whereas all of Israel's, this was just headed very quickly toward destruction. The references to Gilgal and Bethaven, those are both centers of false worship. We'll find later in Hosea there's mention of the sacrificing of bullocks at Gilgal. Bethaven is another interesting replacement name, I think we would say. It actually was a place like next door to Bethel. Bethel meaning house of God. Bethaven meaning house of wickedness. and both names came to be a reference for the same thing. So this is God saying, you know, Bethel, where Jacob had the dream and was blessed, had become a house of false worship. It's one of the two places where the calf worship was set up by Jeroboam at the beginning of the Ten Tribe kingdom. It goes on to mention Israel as a backsliding heifer. It's a fascinating thing. I think the heifer, in contrast to the sheep, is a large, fat animal that does not have the relationship to the shepherd that the sheep has. Ephraim is the chief element of the nation of Israel. It's interesting because the name means fruitful. And you mentioned Jezreel earlier. That is one of the chief places in Ephraim, one of the greatest blessings of the whole land of Israel, which I think ties in with the thought of being fruitful. And I think this is really an admonition to Judah not to follow the course of Ephraim, but to let him alone, not to follow that. It can also be a reference back to the fact that they would abide many days later without the king and without teraphim and so forth. Mm-hmm. I'll stop there.
Well, one last one. It says, come up not to Gilgal. What do we do with Gilgal?
Well, Gilgal was a place of false worship that both Gilgal and Beth-Aven were close enough to Judah that they could have followed that course. That was my reading of it, mm-hmm. that they should not enter in as Israel had into false worship.
You know, again and again, as have you seen from the comments that Brother John gave, part of the sin of Israel was replacing things that were righteous, places which were righteous, with corrupted things, taking good things and making them bad, like Bethel, Beth-Aven. And Gilgal is another example of that. You probably remember Gilgal, which means a rolling away or a circle. I like the rolling away because we first come across Gilgal at the end of the 40 years of wandering. Israel comes into Gilgal, and the whole nation is circumcised there. You know, and the rolling away of the foreskin, the circumcision process, shows that they're putting that behind them, their experiences in Egypt now, and this is a renewed commitment to the covenant they had with their God. So Gilgal represented something new, something wonderful, a good start. And now what it had been corrupted to, it has become a place of idol worship. Again and again, that is the feature or characteristic of false worship, the replacing of what is good and just and righteous with what is false, erroneous, and corrupting. Let's go on to chapter 5. Brother Wes Kramer is going to give us some insights into it. Incidentally, brethren, although we've assigned just one person in each of these chapters, we welcome comments from any of the other brethren if they've come up with any points that would be helpful here. In chapter 5, in verse 1, it starts us off with a responsibility. Who is responsible primarily for Israel's backsliding? Brother Wes?
In verse 1, I think our particular focus is when it says, hear ye this, O priests, and hearken ye, house of Israel, and give ye ear, O house of the king. Our eyes focused on the priests and on the kings. We're talking here about the leadership. The leadership is what bears the special responsibility. And in this particular situation, what's really interesting, it was not just because the leaders of, and again, we're talking primarily the Ten Tribe Kingdom at this point. It wasn't primarily, wasn't so much that they prevented the people, that they failed to prevent the people from falling into idolatry and this apostasy. But as we go on to the latter part of verse 1, what's really interesting, it says, because ye leaders, have been a snare on Mizpah and a net spread upon Tabor. So here it was not only just the fact that the leaders failed to prevent Israel from going into apostasy, they actually led them into apostasy. So it really magnified the importance of the condemnation here upon the leadership, Israel's leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about good kings and bad kings in Judah and Israel. And it's not to say that the nation as a whole doesn't have any responsibility, but it does show how important the leadership is. When there was a good king, the nation prospered. Why? Because they took the lead in worship. They made sure that the certain precepts of following the law covenant and worshiping Jehovah were followed. They didn't tolerate, to a large degree, the false things. When you had a bad king, a bad ruler, they took the lead in false worship. They encouraged it. And again, the nation as a whole does bear some responsibility, but prime responsibility rests with the leadership. Let us jump down to verse 7. Being Bible students, we're always interested in chronological references. Verse 7 says, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord, against Jehovah. They have begotten strange children. Now a month devour them with their portions. Brother Wes or any of the other brethren, do you have any thought about what this month might be?
Well, we're not certain. We'll offer a suggestion that the month here may be not referring to a literal month, and it may not be some kind of a symbol for some precise mathematical calculation, but rather it simply may mean a short period of time. That this destruction would actually occur, the destruction of the 10-tribe kingdom would occur quickly. And if we look at history and we see the invasion of the Assyrian army, the besiegement and the removal of the people from the 10-tribe kingdom area out of that land, taken to Assyria and spread around the different cities of Assyria, that happened, at least my understanding is, that happened relatively quickly. So that happened in a symbolic month, so to speak. It happened fast.
Yeah. Okay, a short period of time. Any other thoughts on that? Brother Rick?
This is like a 2-cent thought.
Okay, 2-cent thought.
Verse 7, it says, at the end, it says, now shall a month devour them with their portions. Drop down to verse 12. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as a rottenness. I don't know that moth might not have been meant in verse 7 as well as verse 12.
Okay, thank you. I didn't look up the Hebrew, so we have a little homework to do.
Brother David, I remember this funny, peculiar moth. We were talking about this back around Christmas time with Brother John. It's quite fascinating to see the moth there again. I forgot about it. We should have checked sooner. I'm just checking the Hebrew right now.
Okay. If you come up with anything, let us know.
Yeah. I can't imagine every translation, including the Hebrew ones, though, having moth and month and not having it correctly, because it's in all the translations. I mean.
All right. Let's go to verse 8. Curious construction here. We've been talking primarily about Israel. But this could be read in different ways. But from King James, it says, blow ye the cornet in Gibeah and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Bethaven after thee, O Benjamin. Almost as though Benjamin was being told here to blow the trumpet. What does this mean? Brother West, you have a thought on that?
The King James here may be a little bit misleading. If you look at the NAS, the Rotherham, the NIV, and others, Benjamin here is not the one blowing the trumpet. Benjamin is the one who is to be listening for the trumpet or listening for the alarm. The reference in the first part of verse 8 to Gibeah and Ramah and Bethaven, we understand these were areas in the northern kingdom. This was areas in the northern, in the 10-tribe kingdom. But we know that Benjamin and Judah were the two tribes that comprised the southern kingdom, the 2-tribe kingdom. So the other translations, and if I can be just a little dramatic here for just a moment, okay, it would read something like this. Blow ye the cornet in Gibeah and the trumpet in Ramah. Cry aloud at Bethaven, behind thee, Benjamin! In other words, the destruction was coming upon Israel, and look out, Benjamin, because it's right on your heels. You're right next to it. You're right on the border, and it's going to happen to you next. So it was an alarm. It was to sound an alarm to Benjamin, which would be the southern kingdom, that this destruction would quickly happen. And if we look at history, we know that that there was only about 125 years difference between the time that the Assyrian army invaded the northern kingdom and took them captive, removed them from the land, and the time that the Babylonian kingdom had come in and invaded the southern kingdom, and of course overthrew Zedekiah and took the remaining Israelites captive into Babylon. There wasn't that much time that occurred between those two events, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm. It almost sounds like Jehovah's tapping Judah and Benjamin on the shoulder and say, be aware, look what's happening here because of what they're doing, and you folks are kind of sliding in that same direction. All right, very good. In this chapter, we have the occurrence of the word Ephraim. I didn't count them a bunch of times, perhaps more than any other chapter. Why? Why is Ephraim singled out so often in this chapter? Is there some application to Ephraim beyond the typical application to Israel that should command our attention? Wes?
Well, Brother David, again, I'm not sure. We'll offer a suggestion. Again, we think that chapter 5, that the theme of this particular chapter is the indictment against the leadership. And that seems to be the prevailing theme. Now, that may, that we think that perhaps that also follows in the use of the word Ephraim, that it's not just talking about the literal tribe of Ephraim, but we're talking about Ephraim now in a little larger sense. And the sense here is, and this actually ties back into what you mentioned in some of your introductory remarks, and that is Ephraim was the prominent tribe. This was the prominent tribe of the ten tribe kingdom. You have, for example, Joshua. If you go back a little further in time, Joshua came from the tribe of Ephraim. Joshua was a leader. So the tribe of Ephraim was associated with prominence or heavy influence. So again, it may be that the usage or the reference here to Ephraim, again, is talking about the influential ones, the ones that have the leadership skills and capabilities and those who use them. So again, talking about the leadership.
Yeah, I think that's consistent, certainly in the history back there. In modern history, too, you find certain families, I'm going to substitute families for tribes, that are particularly prominent and influential. I mean, in our history, just in the recent history, if I was to say the Rockefeller family, well, you would know, well, they're very influential. There's a lot of different Rockefellers that have been involved in government, in commerce, the Bush family, you've got a president and a governor. Examples of leadership and examples of responsibility on family. So the same idea was here, as Brother Wes expressed. Our last verse of chapter 5, again, as we're seeing in the other chapters, seems to have a note of confidence in it. And we read, I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face in their affliction. They will seek me early. So again, we have a rather despondent judgment message being concluded by a ray of hope. They will seek early. How early? What does the word early mean here? Brother West, do you have a thought on that in particular?
Well, in terms of how that God abandons Israel and how long, it would really be, as the verse says, till they acknowledge their offense. There has to be a repentance before there's going to be a healing, as it were, with the nation. We certainly think that it won't be until after, or wouldn't be until after 1878, and perhaps even more fully, perhaps after Jacob's trouble, when they look upon him whom they have pierced, and they develop that repentant attitude.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on to chapters 6 and 7, and we're going to direct our questions to Brother Rick in this. In chapter 6, verse 2, it says, after 2 days will he revive us, and the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Brother Rick, what's meant by after 2 days and in the third day?
Well, we think this is phrases that we're familiar with. A day can represent 1,000 years. 1,000 years is a day. And so we look to think, well, what would be 2 and 3 days here? And we think, of course, in the context, talking about Israel, that in the 33 A.D., Israel went into their 1,845-year period of disfavor for rejecting Messiah. That would have been in the fifth 1,000-year day from Adam. And that 1,845 years from 33 A.D. would bring them down to 1878, which would have been in the seventh 1,000-year day from Adam. So after 2 days, the fifth 1,000-year day, the sixth 1,000-year day, in the third, in the seventh 1,000-year day, starting in 1874, he will revive us, and they started to be revived in 1878, as mentioned.
Okay, thank you. What are God's priorities, as suggested in this book, Brother Rick?
Well, as you could see, in verse 4, there's such a lamentation. It's God speaking through the prophet. Oh, Ephraim, what shall I do unto thee? Oh, Judah, what shall I do unto thee? For your goodness, or your mercy, is as a morning cloud, and as the early dew it goeth away. the reforms that the 10 tribes and 2 tribes had made, they evaporated so quickly. And the Lord is almost like, what can I do for you? You can think of a parent with a child that you've given their little punishments and they aren't learning. What can I do to you? But he gets to the point in verse 6 where he says, the Lord is saying, this is what I really want. I desired mercy, that is love, and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings, the knowledge of his laws, his ways, his principles, so they would grow up to have right characters and then have a real personal relationship. This is what he really desired. And it certainly smacks for us of 1 Corinthians 13, where we read that, though I speak in the tongues of men and angels and have not love, I become a sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. Though I give my body to be burned and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. So similarly, spiritual Israel can suffer if we don't get the right principles of the Lord working in our lives.
You know, this verse that you just read, verse 6, reminded me of Brother Bob Gray's comment earlier, how there was an idolatry problem in this phase of Israel's experiences, but later on they had a Pharisaical problem. And this verse addresses that one as well. The Pharisees became so tied up with the ritual that they forgot mercy. They forgot knowledge of God. These issues of the heart instead of issues of practice. In verse 7 it says, but they like men have transgressed. Like men. Does this mean that just the common sin of mankind? Is that what that means, Brother Rick?
Well, we're blessed here. Even in the King James margin, verse 7, it says, but they like men, and it's like Adam. And that really is the thought in the Hebrew. They were like Adam. They transgressed the covenant. And Adam, of course, broke the covenant he had with God in the Garden of Eden and suffered the chastisement of being expelled. So Israel, likewise, had broke the covenant they had made with God at Sinai, and eventually they would be expelled.
Okay. Verse 8, Gilead is singled out. What was particularly important about Gilead?
Well, it's interesting. It says Gilead is as a city, and there's really no city named Gilead. It's an area. It's an area that's predominantly east of the Jordan River. It's known as a mountainous area, hard and rocky. And Gilead was noted for its iniquity, and when it says polluted with blood in the King James, the Hebrew is more of the thought it's got tracks of blood. And historically, they say that the priesthood in this area, the priests, were like a crime syndicate, and they used murder and robbery and lies, and they abused the people that passed through. They basically robbed them. So remember when Paul said in his journeys that when he journeyed, he was in threat of various things. And one of the things he says, thieves. Well, that really was a real trouble in those days. And Gilead particularly had this as part of its reputation.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, I'm looking at our time, and we're dying here. You know, I think I'm going to change what we want to do a little bit. We have the assignments. I'm going to go the assignments here. Bob Gray has chapters 8 and 9. And just ask one question to kind of move us toward the end here. Bob, in these two chapters, what particularly impressed upon your mind? I mean, is there a point or two that you would say that we could pick out from this that is especially important? And the rest of you, brethren, as we go on, if you could look at the chapters that you've been assigned as well, so we can kind of summarize here a little bit better. Brother Bob, please. Just a thought or a comment that you thought was particularly helpful.
Golly, Dad. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. We start off with a warning. I'm reminded of Jeremiah sounding the alarm, sounding the trumpet, sounding the shofar. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, all these fellows were doing. They're just getting, pardon the expression, all these ancient worthies were doing, these prophets. And when you get down to what's happening, they are condemned for their failures. They've set, verse 4, let's go to verse 4. They've set up kings, but not by me. They have princes, and I knew it not. Their silver and gold have they made idols of, that they may be cut off. Thy calf, O Samaria, has cast thee off. Samaria, of course, is where the calf worship was. Jeroboam set it up a long time earlier. The Lord sent a prophet from Judah at one time. in the book of Kings, and it was condemned, and it said these terrible things would happen to it. They were filled with vileness. But, you know, the vileness goes back a long way, back to the days even of Samuel, when Samuel was told by the Lord what was going to happen to Eli and his family. This is not something that just generated out of nothing. This was a long-range problem. And it goes back even further, because chapter 9 deals with, of course, the horrific. I should mention the lovers first. There's this issue of the lovers in chapter 8. They are trying to hire a lover, much as Israel now is begging upon the United States constantly for assistance and aid and so forth, and is dependent upon it. And I'm afraid that the quote roadmap concept for Israel is being laid out by one of her lovers, maybe her only lover, and it's a dire circumstance. And the sooner the community in Israel realizes this, the better. But that's in the Lord's hands. Chapter 9, of course, brings up another matter, and that matter has to do with, or am I jumping ahead in my thinking here, with the horrific experiences that occurred with respect to Gibeah. I'm looking for the exact verse here, but the reference to Gibeah, let's see, where am I?
Verse 9?
Yep, that's it. They have deeply corrupted themselves. So, yes, there is corruption, but it's not new corruption. It's as in the days of Gibeah. Now, Gibeah is where Saul came from. Gibeah is where he had his kingdom, the center of his kingdom, interestingly enough. But Gibeah is also the place where a man was traveling through and decided not to stop among strangers. He decided not to stop in Jebus, which is the Jebusite city, which became Jerusalem. He says, no, no, we'll go on to another place, and then we'll go to Gibeah, to his servant. And they stopped there. But he was traveling also with a concubine. And the sadness of it is that although a man takes him into his home, much that as Lot took into his home the two angels, this man takes this stranger and his servant, plus the concubine, into his home. But then the children of Belial, much the same as they were in Sodom, wanted the man. And instead, the man of the house offers his daughter. And the other fellow offers his concubine. And they decide they don't want the daughter. They take the concubine. And then it uses the word, they force her. They use force. And that is equivalent to the word rape. And unfortunately, this is what they did. And they essentially murdered her. They left her virtually dead. Then there's more tragedy that comes with it. But the epitome, this man took the concubine, cut her up into 12 pieces, and sent her to all parts of Israel. And said, look what's happening in this land. And this was in the days of the judges. So they had progressed, but they progressed downward again. And that was how vile it became. Much as the sons of Eli were vile, and Eli was closing his eyes to the matter. Mm-hmm. The corruption of the priests, the corruption of the community was endemic.
Yeah, that awful experience, as Bob mentioned, is in the book of Judges, chapter 19, and the tribe of Benjamin was almost exterminated as a result of that. And perhaps that extermination was one of the things that Hosea, having this message from God, wanted Israel to remember. Let's move on to chapter 10. This was to be Brother Ken Rawson's chapter. Just a couple of observations here. In verse 10, it makes mention here, near the end, when they shall bind themselves in two furrows. I believe in the Hebrew, two transgressions. And I like an application to the double condemnation or double iniquity that Brother Rick made mention of early on. I think that fits an application here. And in verse 11, it says, Ephraim is as an heifer that is taught and loveth to tread the corn. But I passed over her fair neck, and I will make Ephraim to ride. Judah shall plow, and Jacob shall break his clods. Remember the comment earlier about heifer. You think of something as a sort of fat, not so much of a work animal. Ephraim, Israel by extension, had gotten very lazy. They weren't working for righteousness, but they were living a life of ease, a life of immorality. And so it says that you like to tread the corn. Well, of all the work that farm animals could do, the treading the corn was the easiest. Plowing was hard. This was easy. Well, God says, I'm going to pass upon her fair neck. I'm going to make a judgment here, and she's going to ride. She's going to plow. Things are going to change a little bit. I love some of the imagery here, how it would have been especially understood by those in an agricultural environment. For us city folk, quote unquote, some of these references are a bit more obscure. In verse 13, of course, it shows where they should have put her trust. Ye have plowed wickedness, ye have reaped iniquity. Ye have eaten the fruit of lies, because thou didst trust in thy way, in the multitude of thy mighty men. Again, whenever we or any of the worshipers of God stop trusting in him and trust in our own judgment and our own desires, we're going to get in big trouble. Brother John Baker, we're going to come back to you. Any thoughts from chapter 11 that you'd like the brethren to take with them?
Yeah, I think the picture changes here, and this is the struggle of a father with a wayward son. That we can apply verse 1 in different ways to Jesus, the church, and to Israel. If we take the context on down, this is in regard to Ephraim. 3 and 4 are very precious. I think a father taking a son in arms and trying to teach them the right way and so forth. And if we add in Jeremiah 31:20, Jeremiah has already noted that Ephraim is destroyed at that point. And God says, what shall I do with my son? It's kind of a lament. And he says, yet will I have mercy upon him. And here, the Lord is still going through in verse 8. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver thee, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I set thee as Zeboim? Those are two of the cities destroyed in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then it says, mine heart is turned within me. My compassions are kindled together. I think it really shows the side of the Lord. He does not willingly afflict the children of men. This is something that he had to do for their correction. So it really gives that pathos of the father with a wayward child.
Yes, God's love here is so abundant. As you said, that there's almost regret that he has to carry out this, but he must do it for his own righteous laws, his own righteousness. But he sincerely loves them, and he desires them to be restored. Thank you, Brother John. Brother West, chapter 12. Any thoughts that you'd like to provide just in summary of that chapter which are worthwhile?
There are many beautiful thoughts in chapter 12. We'll just try to move through them very quickly here. Verse 12 of chapter 11 kind of is a transition verse. It's kind of because it's now taking us back to, as you mentioned earlier, all through this chapter we see this conscious vacillation between punishment and the need for correction, and also the compassion and the love that the father has for his children. So in verse 12 of chapter 11, we're transitioning now back into more of the punishment, more of the discipline type of aspect. We appreciate it in 12:1. It says, Ephraim feedeth on wind and followeth after the east wind. Well, if you think about it, when you feed on wind, what are you feeding on? You're not feeding on anything. There's no nutrition if you take a bite of air. And that's what Israel was doing. They were not feeding on the things that God was providing. They were feeding on air. They were feeding on nothing that was going to nourish them. But even worse, they were feeding on the east wind. The east wind in Israel is a very dry, destructive wind. When the east wind comes in, look out. You're in trouble, or Israel's in trouble. So this was a picture. This was an imagery. This was imagery of destruction. So not only were they not feeding on things that were nourishing, they were actually feeding on that which was destructive, which was the idolatry, the corruption, the immorality, the going after the worship of Baal and all those sorts of things. And of course, Hosea is trying to remind them. He's trying to teach them here what it is that they were doing. Going down to verses 3-6. Really appreciated this section. It says, he took his brother by the heel in the womb. Here's talking about Jacob and Esau. Mm-hmm. And by his strength he had power with God. Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us. Even the Lord God of hosts, the Lord is memorial. Therefore turn thou to thy God, keep mercy and judgment, and wait on thy God continually. Here is a beautiful reference. Again, it's a wake-up call. It's a reminder by Hosea to Israel. Look, you know, one of your ancestors whom you and I both respect, his name is Jacob. And Jacob had to struggle. Jacob struggled. Jacob went after the birthright. Granted, Esau wanted to sell it for a mess of pottage, but Jacob worked for it. The his inheritance of the Abrahamic promise was not just because he was a nice guy. Jacob, we see over and over, Jacob wrestled with the angel. What was the result of that struggle? It was the blessing that he received. And so what I think Hosea here is very appropriately telling Israel, look, your ancestor worked hard to get you what you have. Your ancestor worked hard to get you in a covenant relationship with God. Don't throw it away. It's kind of like what we hear today of, or how the military people must feel about the flag burners. They say they don't realize, you know, what their ancestors gave, what their forefathers gave for their freedom.
The price of liberty.
The price of liberty. Yeah. And the same kind of concept, I think, was what Isaiah, or Hosea, rather, was trying to get across. There's just one other thing, if I may just...
Make it quick, please.
Okay. In verse 11, we have a reference to... In verse 7. In verse 7, we have a reference to someplace. I'm losing my place here. It's a reference to the Canaanite. I thought it was verse 7. He is a merchant and the balances of the deceiver.
I think a merchant, isn't that Canaanite?
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. I forgot my train of thought on that. Anyway, the Canaanite here... Again, this was a very serious wake-up call by Hosea. He's calling them a Canaanite.
Yeah, that's the Hebrew for he is a merchant.
He is a merchant, because the Canaanites were merchants. This was a contemptuous word. Hosea is saying, you Canaanites. Of course, you know, that would be a very contemptuous word to them. That was a four-letter word that he was using to describe the Israelites. And of course, it was a wake-up call, because essentially that's what they had become. Through their practices, they had become Canaanites.
Yes. Thank you, Brother Wes. Well, according to my watch, we've got 90 seconds left. So, I'm going to just make a few comments on chapter 14, then we're going to have to come to a close. Chapter 14 ends the book of Hosea on a very positive note. It's a very wonderful chapter that draws things together. It shows the repentance of Israel. For example, in verse 3, this is Israel speaking now. Not God speaking, but Israel speaking. Asher shall not save us. They're acknowledging where true salvation comes from. We will not ride upon horses, neither will we say any more to the work of our hands, ye are our gods. For in thee the fatherless find mercy. So it's repentance and now acceptance of what their God has given them. In verse 2, there's this expression here, we will render the calves of our lips. Remember earlier we saw that it wasn't all these ritual sacrifices that God was truly looking for. He was looking for mercy. He was looking for a knowledge of God, for compassion. The calves of our lips is an expression about the praises, the sacrifices of praise that we would give. And it says, we will render. Again, this is Israel making these statements. And so... it's really quite beautiful. Let me read just the last few verses, starting from verse 4. God speaking, I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be, now notice that expression, I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily and cast his roots as Lebanon. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them. I read that. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon. They that dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall receive as the corn and grow as the vine, and scent shall be as the wine of Ephraim. Verse 9, who is wise and shall understand these things, prudent, and he shall know them? For the ways of Jehovah are right, and the just shall walk in them, and the transgressors shall fall in them. So this terribly depressing judgment that is interspersed with good promises ends on a very positive note. And so Hosea gives to Israel their last hope to change, which he knew that they wouldn't. They would be judged, but ultimately their God would come back to them and restore them to what they had earlier, the condition of Jezreel, full favor. I apologize that we didn't do a little bit better on some of the details in the middle, but we hope that this did, in fact, spur you on to a further study. Now, you're going to see a lot of books this weekend that are going to spur you on to study, but the Minor Prophets are truly a treasure house full of good and wonderful things. Good leg.
Thank you, Brother David, and for the efforts of you and the panel.